Welcome to a new episode of What Exactly Am I Watching Here, a proud member of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host, for now, Jason Helms, and I'm joined by my willing test subject, Dominic Lang. Say hi, Dom.
Hey, Jason. Good to be back.
Now, you listen to me. While I will admit to a certain cynicism, the fact is that I am a naysayer and hatchet man in the fight against ignorance. I pride myself in taking a punch, and I'll gladly take another, because I choose to live my life in the company of Gandhi and King. My concerns are global. I reject absolutely revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such method is love. I love you, Dom.
I love you too, Jason.
All right. I think that's as good a way to begin as any. Before we get to it further in, a quick introduction to the show. What Exactly Am I Watching Here is a podcast that features an expert and a novice watching one of the great shows of television history. Like Obi-Wan training Luke, like Miyagi training Daniel-san, like Virgil guiding Dante through the various layers of hell, but where Virgil uses Wikipedia and Netflix to help explain things along the way, I will be guiding our good friend Dom through the inferno that is Twin Peaks Season 2.
Yes.
And we're diving in today to Season 2, the first four episodes. I encourage you to check out the show for yourself. Please watch it before you listen to us. It's available on Amazon Prime and Netflix. Listen to our previous episodes and come up with some of your own theories about the strange and wondrous place that is Twin Peaks. Mm. All right, Dom, where did we leave off?
So we left off just having finished Season 1, and we don't have confirmation yet of who killed Laura Palmer, which is up until now kind of the like binding mystery of the show. Twin Peaks opens with the discovery of Laura Palmer's body, and Agent Dale Cooper comes into town intent on unmasking the killer. So at the end of Season 1, we still don't know who killed Laura yet. There's a massive fire at the local lumber mill, and we're not sure who's dead, who's alive. There are several people shot, suffocated, overdose. We have Audrey, one of our main characters, held against her will at One Eye Jack's, which is a brothel north of the border. And Agent Cooper, our lead, at the last scene of Season 1, he opens the door of his hotel room and he is shot three times by an unknown assailant.
Great. So it sounds like we're ready to break down the episodes episode by episode.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, before we took a full dive into Season 2, I wanted to maybe just like address some of the hang-ups or even the kind of things that I'd heard before getting into Twin Peaks. Or basically, in a nutshell, like, why do people not watch Twin Peaks? And Jason, as a kind of an expert on the show or a kind of my guide to it, maybe just a couple of like first reactions and impressions. So
yeah, and let me distinguish two things first.
Yeah.
Why do people not watch the show? Or better yet, why do people stop watching the show?
Continue. Yeah. One of the things that I always kind of heard as a deterrent, or again, either when they would not watch it or stop watching it, are the characters are weird and I don't know what's going on. And so, Jason, when you hear stuff like that, what are kind of maybe some of the questions you ask or things that you say to kind of spark conversation?
If you don't get in by episode 3 or 4, in some sense, I've got nothing for you.
Okay.
You've got all you need that will keep you along, that will keep you warm for the travel. and that's okay. It's nothing against you. People like different shows. That's fine. There's going to be a slow trade-off. I kind of forecast this with you that you're going to start to love the Ben and Jerry eating a baguette scenes more and more and more as the show goes on. And if you don't enjoy those shows, those scenes in the first few episodes, well, you're not going to enjoy them more. And that's kind of the direction we're headed. So I get it. The characters are absolutely weird.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on. I think people deceive themselves on that one.
Really?
Yeah. You don't know what's going on. That's true. You absolutely don't.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also not supposed to. It's a mystery, right? You don't say that when you watch Sherlock Holmes. I don't know who killed him yet.
Yeah.
That's kind of the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, I think, what people are saying. What I think people are saying is, this is unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
Not just the topics, but the way it's being presented.
Okay.
You actually know a great deal of what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? You know a lot about Laura Palmer. A lot about Laura Palmer that a lot of people in the town of Twin Peaks don't know. You know a lot about James. You know about his mother. You know all kinds of things. The question is, where do I put it all? How do I make sense of it? And it's resisting that kind of easy solution. Twin Peaks is never going to give you that easy solution. So let me dispel that. When you find out who killed Laura Palmer, if you find out who killed Laura Palmer, Twin Peaks isn't done. Yeah. It hasn't solved itself, and you don't get to this place where you say, okay, well, now I know what's going on.
Huh.
It's always going to resist that kind of solution, which to me is kind of the genius and what I love about Twin Peaks. I can watch these old episodes and still fall in love with it and still have it resist me, still be off-put by things, and yet also find it a place that I'm at home because I love these weird characters.
Yeah. Gosh, that's a great distinction for me of like what are people actually saying when they say, I don't know what's going on. It's almost like, I don't know why it's going on.
Yeah.
Or like why I'm seeing what I'm seeing. Like I can very concretely see that Ben and Jerry are like gorging themselves on baguettes. I see that. I don't know like the why of it or the kind of how this all connects. And you're right. Like we know tons about Laura and can like have a far more accurate representation of who this woman was than we did at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And I mean, something else, the first four episodes of season two, in one sense, it feels really slow.
Yes.
A lot of the questions we had at the end of season one have not been answered.
Yeah.
And so you might say, are we moving anywhere? Is anything happening?
Yeah.
And the truth is, I think we've actually discovered a lot. It just didn't happen to be answers to the questions we had.
Awesome. Awesome. So yeah, I think with that, we should dive into season two.
All right. So let's do an episode breakdown. We'll start with episode 8/episode 1 of season two.
Cool.
May the giant be with you. As Cooper lies bleeding from a serious gunshot wound, he has a vision of a mysterious giant who helps him with the investigation. Albert Rosenfield arrives in Twin Peaks the next morning to assist Cooper and to investigate his attack. Meanwhile, Leland Palmer's hair has suddenly turned white, and he continues to act in an unusual way. James remains in jail after being framed by Bobby, who plants Leo's stash of cocaine in James's motorcycle. Big Ed maintains a close watch on Nadine, who, after a suicide attempt, is left in a comatose state. Leo also remains in a coma after being shot by Hank. The sawmill burns down, leaving Catherine and Josie missing, and Shelley and Pete in the hospital after barely escaping the fire. Donna, after receiving some advice from the log lady, decides to look into the Meals on Wheels that Laura worked at. So, two seconds ago, you were ready to say nothing happens in season two.
here's why I said that, I think the first scene of season two, Cooper is on the floor of his hotel room, shot, bleeding, and a hotel staff member comes in with room service because Cooper had ordered a glass of milk just before being shot. So this elderly hotel staff comes in, and what feels like the worst Abbott and Costello routine ever plays out over the course of
it's so good. Go on.
But and if I'm honest, this was the first time where I thought, oh, this is why people don't like Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And
I totally get that.
So I think like I guess the dissonance of what I was feeling was the fact that like Cooper's been shot, he's bleeding, like I don't feel any urgency. Instead, I feel like this is treated like a slapstick, and where I struggle was like circumstance versus consequence, where like Twin Peaks can feel uncanny and there can be a sense of foreboding or unknowing or mystery, but there was always consequence.
Yeah.
And that scene felt like it was void of consequence. like they could just talk forever and like Cooper wouldn't continue to bleed, or like I think that's where I was really just kind of like, okay, it felt like I was wasting a lot of goodwill that it had built up over the first season.
Yep.
The Giants' appearance at the end of that scene, or kind of like a transition, then it kind of felt like, oh, like now we're starting. And specifically, like the Giants' line. So Cooper asks the Giant where he comes from. And the Giant says, the question shouldn't be, where do I come from? But where have you gone? And that for me, just like an interesting notion, like a discussion of place.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks as a unique or set apart place.
Yeah.
For me, like that's where I think some of the more interesting stuff of season two has to do with the notion of place. And so maybe, you know, that's a spot for you to kind of illuminate me.
I'm gonna change the stakes, or that's what I'm gonna do is contextualize it a little bit. You had to wait a week, mm-hmm. right, to start watching season two.
Yeah.
And then you started off and you felt like, oh my gosh, this has no stakes. Like, what is happening in this opening scene? I feel like David Lynch does not respect me.
Yeah.
Imagine you had to wait 5 months, like the original viewers did. And in between, there were entertainment shows and magazines that were talking about, you know, who killed Laura Palmer. What's going to happen next? So that feeling that you have, you're wrong in the sense that it should be more intense. You should feel like, screw you, David Lynch. How dare you? I've been waiting months for this.
Yeah.
It's not just, I'm not sure. I mean, to really get how angry the contemporary viewers were with this, they were livid. You're absolutely right. It feels there's no consequences. There's no... You wrote in the notes, if everything is special, is nothing special. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, and that was something where it just felt like the waiter appearing and having this like this Abbott and Costello routine with Agent Cooper, and then I think the scene in the next episode, which we'll get to, the Meals on Wheels scene where like a magic trick happens. It just felt like if everything is special, is nothing special? Is there no consequence? Or like the fact that I think there's a barbershop quartet in the background of a breakfast scene, and they're never like acknowledged, never spoken of. And again, it just feels like there's no consequence or significance.
So let's flip this around, because I started with and I want to come back to the is if everything's special, is nothing special. I want to just really focus in on that. But first, let's jump back to this idea of, because you nodded at this, David Lynch does not respect me, right? It feels like David Lynch is trolling you.
Yeah, totally.
This is Albert's quote, okay?
Okay.
That I started with about, I love you, Sheriff Truman, right?
Yeah.
You may think that I'm callous. You may think that I'm a jerk, but I love you. And that's where this is coming from. That is David Lynch. That is his voice. When you think that I don't respect you, that's when I respect you the most. One of the weirdest things about David Lynch and this filmmaking style, and I think you actually commented on it during the season one, is, wow, I've never seen a show that respects the viewer as much as this.
Yeah.
It really expects a lot from us. And that's not, I'm not going to now give you the key to that scene to here's how to really get it. It's like, but no, it expects you to work at that. It expects you to not, it's not going to jump in and ease you into this. It really respects the hell out of you. You know, to add some more context, David Lynch took 25 years off from this show and decided to come back.
Yeah.
And then he threatened to quit so that he could get enough money, not for his own paycheck, but to throw back into it. To really spend on the cast that he wanted, the production values that he wanted, so that he could make the show that he wanted to make. I mean, he really, really cares about this show. He really, really, really respects the viewers.
Mm.
But that also means that it's going to be a relationship. There's going to be some push and pull.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that kind of make some sense?
It does make some sense. It doesn't make it any more, I guess, elucidating of why it just feels like like he's being opaque or evasive for the sake of being opaque and evasive.
Right. Right. Right.
Again, the distinction between like ambiguity or mystery and just plain obscurity.
Right.
And so like where in a mystery, like Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, there is still kind of like a format or a rhythm that you have. Whereas I don't know the difference where season one still felt like kind of a transplant of Lynch's dreams, like into a film medium. This still very much feels like that, but it feels like we're going off the rails. To an extent. And I feel like at times as I'm going through these episodes of season two, it feels like it is alternatively like getting better and getting worse.
Yep.
And I'm not entirely sure why yet.
Let me flip it for you real quick.
Okay.
You make a show and you decide to put your dreams on display. The most intimate part of you for all of America.
Hmm.
And unfortunately it becomes a hit. And everyone watches it and everyone wants to come to know what's next.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Oh boy.
I mean, in some sense you want to push back, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not ready for that.
No.
But that's what I meant about it being a relationship. The other thing, I wanted to come back to this idea that if everything special is nothing special, again, let's return to a relationship.
Okay.
Imagine there's that, who's your best friend? The person you care most about?
Chadwick. His name's Chad. Yeah.
Chad. You and Chad, right? If everything is special is nothing special. That's assuming a kind of scarcity, right? The more scarce something is, the more meaning it has.
Correct.
If everything has meaning, then nothing has meaning. But relationships aren't like that, right? If that's the truth, and it is true, you know, there were people in my life that I didn't see much, and therefore the one moment that they gave me the time of day, it meant the most. Well, that was a crappy relationship. That's not a good thing.
True.
You know, when you think about your relationship with Chadwick, you know, I think about my relationship with my wife. It's having coffee in the morning. Right? That one quiet little moment. And sometimes it's the loud moment when the kid is screaming and we look at each other and we each get a kind of peace from each other. It's the realization that every moment is special. And what's wrong is that I'm missing it and I need to pay attention. There is a kind of scarcity. We've only got so much life. But everything really is special and I need to stop and pay attention to it and look at it. I think the everything is special is the moral of Twin Peaks, all the way up to the current one. I think you've already gotten it. Which is that idea that if everything is special, is nothing special? No, absolutely not. Everything is special. Enjoy. This is the world. This is the life you get. Dive into it. Dig deep.
Yeah, that feels, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but that feels very much in line with a Zen approach or like take on the world. Yeah,
absolutely. And in order to think back about scarcity and meaning, there's a famous story in Zen about a student who came to a master and asked to be taught. Said, you know, I'm a good Buddhist and all, but I need to get Zen. I need this thing that you have that I don't have. And the master was like, no, I'm not going to give it to you. No, I'm not going to do it. I just kept, you know, this kind of retreating that I think you see Lynch doing here, right? I'm not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
And the student sat outside in the snow all night. And the master was like, yeah, good for you. Great. Not going to do it.
Huh.
And then the student cut off his arm and handed the arm to the master. And the master said, I'll teach you. That's a famous story in Zen.
Ow.
What do you do with that?
Not cut off my arm.
No.
Step
that
one.
Would be this is another Zen story from the poet Basho.
Yeah.
Not to follow in the footsteps of the masters, but to seek what they sought. To cut off your arm would be to miss the point.
Hmm.
That was his journey. That's not yours.
Yeah.
So what do you need to do? If he needed to cut off his arm, what do you need to do? Seek what he sought.
Wow. Whew.
Where do we go from there?
Oh, man. I personally, my favorite scene of season two, episode one is the exchange between father and son.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that everything is special.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So Major Briggs meets Bobby in the Double R Diner, and to this point, the Major and his son have had a not very strong communication. Like, it's been terrible. It's not been any communication, truthfully. Yeah. It feels like a lot of misfiring. And Major Briggs just, like, comes from a very heartfelt and very sincere place. And I'll just, like, the first part of it, he sits across the diner table from his son. And he says, "A vision I had in my sleep last night, as distinguished from a dream, which is mere sorting and cataloging of the day's events by the subconscious. This was a vision, fresh and clear as a mountain stream, the mind revealing itself to itself." And that, to me, like, to see someone who is, to this point, you always see him in his military uniform, always has that facade of logic, of coldness, and then comes just with this warmth and this radiance. It was truly beautiful. And that small moment was truly, truly special.
Yeah. All the little pieces of it too. I see so much of myself in Major Briggs as a parent.
Mm.
He's incredibly pedantic. And I worry that about myself. Mm. Well, Maddie, you know, you have different choices, and I respect your choices. However, if you follow this path, there will be consequences, and I may impose some of those consequences. You know, that's the way I am as a father. It's terrible.
Got it.
But as I look back at this, the amazing thing is I was so drawn into it. I love this scene. There's so much buildup to it. And he describes this dream.
Mm-hmm.
And two-thirds of the quote is a description of where he is in the dream. This stupid house. Just say, "I was in a house," and then you knocked at the door. That's all we need.
Yep.
But instead we get, "This was my vision, fresh and clear as a mountain stream, the mind revealing itself to itself. In my vision, I was on a veranda of a vast estate, a palazzo of some fantastic proportion. There seemed to emanate from it a light from within, this gleaming, radiant marble. I had known this place. I had, in fact, been born and raised there." Yada, yada, yada. Oh my gosh, it goes on for another, like, 50 words.
Yeah.
And then there's a knock at the door. My son was standing there. He was happy and carefree, clearly living a life of deep harmony and joy. We embraced, warm and loving embrace, nothing withheld. We were in this moment one. My vision ended. That's all we need to get to. All the story is, I had this dream last night. There was a house. Knock at the door. I answer it. My son's there. He seemed happy. We hugged.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the story. And yet he tells it so well.
Mm.
That by the end of it, the great thing, I was watching this with Megan, and she was laughing. She was absolutely laughing at him because he's so goofy and over the top and pedantic.
Yeah.
And you know it's not going to connect with Bobby, and Bobby is rolling his eyes. Come on, Dad.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of it, because Bobby is moved by it, you get moved by it. And
oh,
by the
end of
it, we both got teared up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and this, like, that felt, you know, like what you were saying about if you imagine you, like, have your dreams, you put your dreams on screen and it becomes a national sensation and you have this fault. This felt like just a very tender expression. It felt like a conversation that Lynch could have had with a friend of his over breakfast or just like in a journal. Just like it feels like a journal entry, quite honestly. In the best way possible.
It's an absolutely beautiful moment.
Yeah.
Episode 9.
Take it away.
Season 2, Episode 2. In the midst of the murder investigation and the aftermath of his shooting, Cooper receives the grim news that his insane former partner, Wyndham Earle, has escaped from a mental asylum. Meanwhile, Donna's first day as a Meals on Wheels volunteer leads to an eerie meeting with an old woman and her grandson. Audrey uncovers more about Laura's double life at One-Eyed Jack's, while her investigation becomes increasingly dangerous.
Yeah, and I think you brought this up, Jason, at the beginning as I was getting into the show, but when the show aired originally, correct me if I'm wrong, but the log lady would give these sort of almost like Rod Serling Twilight Zone introductions to the episode. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I've got to correct myself. From what I did a little research, and I think it was actually on the re-airings. Those were added.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. This one for Coma, I found particularly interesting. It's either voiceover, she's talking to camera, she says, "As above, so below. The human being finds himself or herself in the middle. There is as much space outside the human proportionally as inside. Stars, moons, and planets remind us of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Is there a bigger being walking with all the stars within?" And oof. I've been reading actually some stuff by Madeline L'Engle, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
And she writes quite eloquently about that paradox of a creator of stars and moons and planets, but also so of the macro, but also of the micro, of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and neurons, and going even smaller and smaller and smaller. And so the world within being just as large as the world without, the world, you know, outside of you. And yeah, just like that notion for me, like that VO, quite frankly, was more interesting than the episode itself. I don't know. Like, I feel like there's more meat in that little kind of VO or monologue. I don't know. Episode 2 of season 2, I found like particularly frustrating. And
dude, here's the best part. Stopped the quote at, for someone who's rewatching it, literally the most interesting part. Does our thinking affect what goes on outside us and what goes on inside us? I think it does. Where does creamed corn figure into the workings of the universe? What really is creamed corn? Is it a symbol for something else? And we've been going spoilers free. I've been great at this. I've really behaved myself. So I'm just going to spoil. I don't care. I need you to come with me on this. Creamed corn is one of the most important things in the Twin Peaks universe.
Seriously?
It has a name. It's called Garmin Bosia.
Oh my God.
From what I can tell, a made up term.
No. Oh my goodness.
And it signifies Garmin Bosia. Oh, by the way, this is from, I'm reading now, entry from the Twin Peaks wiki. I need you to not ever Google Garmin Bosia because spoiler.
Okay.
Let me just read the opening line. Garmin Bosia has the appearance of creamed corn and refers to pain and sorrow. Like, we're going to get there. We're going to get there.
Oh my gosh. The creamed corn
was not a red herring.
Okay. Because
I need you to know that.
Because that was the scene where Donna goes to her first Meals on Wheels and the grandson, who it turns out, I did IMDb that episode after I watched it, the kid turns out it's David Lynch's son.
I did not know that, but his hair is perfect. That is exactly David Lynch.
Yeah, they did his wardrobe and makeup to resemble his dad.
I had no idea. That's amazing. He's also in the movie.
Oh, cool. I look forward to it.
Yeah.
But he basically takes the cream corn off his grandmother's plate and it winds up in his hands. And so that I was just like, okay, I guess, sure. Like, I don't know. And so that's where it really felt meandering. But the fact that we've got Garmin Bosia on deck.
That sounds right to me.
That's how you pronounce it? Okay. Garmin Bosia. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust you. I'm with you. I'm here. I'm going to trust you.
Oh, man. I'm so excited about the experiences that you have ahead of you.
I am so afraid of cream corn.
You referenced earlier a magic trick. You said, is it just a magic trick? Right? This is what she said. She said, my grandson loves magic. Right?
Yeah.
That's not a magic trick you can do. make creamed corn disappear off of someone's plate and reappear in your hands. And the plate looks as though there was never creamed corn on it. And it's just sitting in your hands. That's not a magic trick people can do. David Blaine can't do that.
Fair.
Chris Angel, Fair. Mind Freak, can't do that.
Well, that you've seen.
That I've seen.
That you've seen.
So the question is, what does she mean? And I think what it points to is that the magic of Twin Peaks is not magic tricks.
Okay.
It's maybe a different kind of magic is what she's talking about.
Okay. I am open to that. I think it's a really interesting theory. I like the sound of it. I'm a little skeptical.
Please.
But it sounds a little bit like we're creating a theory to justify a meandering scene. But we are very early in season two, so just let it sit.
I just wish you knew how many times this scene will be referenced over the next 25 years.
Wow. Like, oh, boy.
This scene. This is like...
I just walked right into it, didn't I? Walked plain into a bucket of Garmin Bozio.
All right. Creamed corn versus chewing gum.
Oh, my gosh.
Creamed corn is much more important, I
really?
Think.
Really?
I think.
Oh,
but
my
I don't
gosh.
Understand the chewing gum perfectly.
Oh, my
creamed
gosh.
Corn is very, very important.
I would have put $100 on chewing gum.
Oh, I know. I'm not sure I get chewing gum.
Oh, I would have lost that bet so hard. Man.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to look into it. I'm sure there's an explanation of chewing gum that I totally missed.
Wow. All right. Cream corn it is.
All right. Anything to add?
No.
Episode 10.
No, I got nothing now. I'm
we got stuck on the log lady voiceover. That was great. all right. Episode 10,
cool.
AKA season 2, episode 3, The Man Behind the Glass. Blackie holds Audrey hostage and plots with Jean Renault. James and Madeline become close, to Donna's dismay. Lucy lunches with Dick Tremaine. Dr. Jacoby undergoes hypnosis, leading to an arrest. And Nadine wakes from her coma, a changed woman. Donna finds a diary of Laura's at Harold Smith's house. Again, how dare you say nothing is happening in season two? Stuff is happening.
Plenty of stuff is happening. I guess... Like,
no, you're right.
Yeah.
I get what you mean. None of the questions you had are being answered.
Yeah, and I suppose that's why the simultaneous things are getting better, but things are getting worse. Where it feels like the things that I didn't have investment in are continuing to progress, whereas the things that I was invested in or did want to know about they feel like they're stalling.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm like, oh no. But can we just can we go back to that, like that line? Can we answer once and for all? Like, so that's I guess where I feel a little despondent or a little just like apprehensive about where things are going with season two.
Let me tell you about my experience of watching the last episode of the most recent season of Twin Peaks.
You're going to tell me?
From what I know.
You're going to talk to me about the finale of the show?
Yeah, the finale. The finale of the show. My experience.
Okay.
And it was... The immediate feeling was frustration.
Huh.
And a lot of, but what about?
Yeah.
And within 24 hours... I'd completely changed my mind on it without reading anything, without listening to anyone else. It was okay. All right.
Mm.
And I want to tell you the details. I want to give you more about what moved me from A to B.
Yeah.
But the reason I told you that is a lot of Twin Peaks happens when you're not watching the show. It's one of the very few shows in my life that I think about when I'm not watching it. Leftovers is that way as well.
Yeah.
Where things click for me. Leftovers is a perfect analog. So much of season one, especially, was so frustrating, so upsetting.
Yeah.
But later, in the shower, when I'm on a run, when I'm doing something else,
mm-hmm.
something would click for me. I'd go, okay, I think I don't understand it now, but I accept it now, or it's changed me. It's making me think about other things.
Yeah. That was, gosh, you just reminded me, the notion of, oh, again, Madeline L'Engle. Holy crap,
yeah.
Jason.
Yeah.
The difference between understanding and acceptance.
Mm.
where I don't have to know why every single thing is there, but I can accept that every single thing is there.
Yeah.
I don't have to know the significance of every moment, but I can appreciate that every moment is special. And that peace with mystery, that calm, where it's like, yeah. And I think maybe that's why Twin Peaks still to this day feels so different than a, I guess, like your standard TV show, even with like what we're now in the age of peak TV or so much television, there's so many shows going on. The need of like, if I don't understand it, then I can't appreciate it. Hmm. And that feels like the common language of, like, I don't know all the details, I can't fully appreciate it.
Right.
Where maybe the argument, or if, you know, like, to put so strong a word on it, the argument being precisely because you can't fully understand it, that is all the more reason to appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even like the, so like Rosenfield's credo, it very much just feels like a shot. Like he speaks straight to Truman's heart. And yeah, it just feels like a declaration of love. It is a declaration of love.
Yeah. Hmm. So what you said reminded me of a poem from William Wordsworth, The Tables Turned, where he starts, "Up, up, my friend, and quit your books. Oh, surely you'll grow double. Up, up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble?" He's telling you, get out of your books and go live life. Go enjoy life. But one of the lines is, let me find it and get it right. Okay. "Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things. We murder to dissect." That line, "we murder to dissect," hits me so hard.
Mm.
We kill things in order to understand them.
Yeah.
In order to analyze them, in order to get it. And that's, to me, the difference between understanding and acceptance. Acceptance, love, refuses to murder, refuses that kind of violence. But dissection, analysis, will always entail a kind of violence with it.
Yeah.
I need to understand you. I need to take you apart to understand you. I need to separate you from everything else to understand who you are. Just be okay with me being me. Just be okay with the world being the world. And that's what love is, not cutting it up.
Yeah. Thomas Merton has this idea of how, like, that notion of "I must understand all of you" is consumptive.
Hmm.
It is this notion of "I have to have all of you." Whereas that acceptance is understand, like, that acceptance of the fact that there's always going to be a mysterious part of the one you love. There is always going to be something to the one you love that you don't know. And when you see it, or like that hidden aspect, there will always be something occluded from your view. And that doesn't mean you can't appreciate or love. It actually, he would argue, enables you to love more and more deeply. Because you are, at that point, sitting with a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, we found a dead end again.
Yep.
with profundity.
Yes.
I apologize.
That's okay, man.
That's great.
I'm loving this, man. This is beautiful.
Hey, when Albert says that to Sheriff Truman, what was your feeling? What was your reaction to that scene in the moment?
Ooh, it came as a shock because up until now, that directness of emotion I'd not seen from Rosenfield yet. And so I wasn't sure where to place it. It did feel very much in the same river as Major Briggs to Bobby. It felt like it felt so clearly like this is David Lynch talking. It felt so very much like an elevation of the moment, like a moment out of time, and a beautiful moment. I think I just thought it was fantastic. And also a great revelation of character that was still consistent with what we've seen. Like, Rosenfield, yeah, is kind of a jerk, kind of a prick, but he's never been one to use violence against someone.
Right.
So it doesn't, like, he's not lying. I can't call him a liar when he says this. I didn't know this about him. And so that's why it feels so surprising. And yeah, like, I don't understand Agent Rosenfield or Rosenfield, but I can appreciate him.
Yeah. Thank you. That was beautiful. That was really great. I was cackling with laughter during it, but also very, very moved. It's weird that Twin Peaks can do both to me at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll need to move on from there to the next episode.
Let's do it.
All right. So episode 11, Laura's Secret Diary. Cooper and Truman arrest Leland after he confesses to the crime of murdering Jacques Renault in the hospital. Hank asks Norma to tidy up the Double R Diner when he is informed that a shady food critic named M.T. Wentz may be visiting Twin Peaks. Meanwhile, Jean Renault shows a videotape of Audrey Horne being held captive to Ben, demanding a $125,000 ransom for her return, and Cooper to be the drop-off man. Upon returning to One-Eyed Jack's, Jean murders Emery Battis for mistreating Audrey. With help from Truman, Cooper prepares to investigate Audrey's kidnapping. Josie returns, claiming to have been in Seattle on business, learning from Pete that Catherine died in the sawmill fire. Later, Japanese businessman Mr. Chojimura checks into the Great Northern Hotel. All right. The first thing I want to say,
yeah,
because I just Googled it, is the food critic.
Yeah.
M.T. Wentz. So here's something interesting. I don't know if it means anything at all.
Okay.
But Wentz is a German name that means filled with praise.
Really?
Praiseworthy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I looked it up. That's what the surname means.
Huh.
Worthy of praise.
Worthy of praise.
M.T. are two initials that sound a lot like the word empty. And it's really funny for a food critic to be named Empty Praise. And for someone who has a show that is a critical darling to feature a critic whose name is Empty Praise.
Man, if that is what you're hinting that it is, that is one of the most clever put downs I've ever seen. And
I don't know. I don't know.
I Googled MT Wentz because it looked like someone saying it was a mountain, like Mount Wentz.
Mount Wentz.
Yeah. Which now I want to visit. I'm going to go see Mount Empty Praise.
Well, and I like the tension there too, right? Like a giant mountain of praise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, I don't know why, maybe just where I'm at, just life-wise, but like these dialogue exchanges are really standing out to me. And so when Judge Sternwood, who comes to Twin Peaks to set bail for Leland Palmer, and there's more business that he's in town for, he asks Agent Cooper, says, "Mr. Cooper, how do you find our little corner of this world?" He says, "Heaven, sir." And says, "Well, this week, heaven includes arson, multiple homicides, and an attempt on the life of a federal agent." And Cooper responds, "Heaven is a large and interesting place, sir."
Such a good line.
Such a good. So this though felt like this was probably, for me, just the most encouraging note of episode 4 going forward in season 2. Sternwood is talking to Leland Palmer, and he says, "The law provides us structure to guide us through paralyzing and trying times, but it requires our submission to its procedures and higher purposes. Before we assume our respective roles in this enduring drama, just let me say that when these frail shadows we inhabit now have quit the stage, we'll meet again and raise a glass again together in Valhalla." And it felt like an acknowledgement of this is a place and we are bound by certain things that are sometimes, for the most part, for our benefit. However, there are consequences to that. But let it be known that this is not the end, that this law or these bounds are not permanent.
That's really sharp. I really like that. This reminds me of what you were asking in the first episode we did about what are the rules here in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And the, you know, what I said is basically there are rules, but in the sense why they're there doesn't matter. They're somewhat arbitrary. And I think that arbitrariness might be to point to what you just said, which is the rules are there for now, but they won't last forever. There's something beyond the rules.
I'm going to be honest here. I came into this conversation with a far more negative view of the first few episodes. And having had this conversation with you, Jason, I have a far more open, nay, optimistic view. Or I guess just like an appreciation for it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm realizing, I guess, just a contemporary bias. Like I'm coming in with the mindset of like 21st century television that by and large is formulaic. I guess a little less nowadays, but still, for the most part, playing the same songs. And this is of an entirely different cloth. And it feels like it has to be dealt with differently because it's a different fabric, a different expression. But like you said, Wordsworth quote, "We murder to dissect." I think I do the show a disservice by trying to, you know, square a peg in a round hole. Like Twin Peaks in that sense, it is, yes, a TV show in that it was a show that aired on television, but not a TV show in the sense that it has a formula that fits the 42-minute model of most American TV shows.
Yeah. Yeah, Twin Peaks is not something to be understood. It's something to help you understand yourself, which is weird. It's not what you typically look at for a TV show. That's what you look at maybe a devotional for, or some kind of spiritual writing, but that's going to be David Lynch's goal.
I agree. So thank you, Jason, for that.
Hey, I'm so glad. It's working out. This is great.
This is really fun. Thank you, man.
Anything you want to do before we exit? Do you want to give us thoughts on season two, where we're going, anything like that, or just write it? Stop doing predictions.
For now, man, I'm just going to ride it. Let's let it ride.
Cool. Well, then in that case, thanks again for joining us on What Exactly Am I Watching Here. For our next podcast episode, we're going to go ahead and watch 5 episodes of Twin Peaks because it creates a more natural cut. So go ahead, watch episodes 5 through 9 of season 2, and we will see you back here in just a few weeks. So off you go with the Bookhouse Boys. You can get a hold of us on Twitter, where our handle is @OverthinkPod, and find more at OverthinkPod.com. And Dom.
Jason.
I'm so glad to have had this opportunity to share this with you. I wish you nothing but the very best. Always.
I love you, Jason.
I love you too, Dom.